Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is May 4th, 2014, and I'm talking with Ron Butwin and Tom Zippy Kaplan from The Uniques. Let's start out with your full name, your date of birth, and your hometowns, please. Ron, you first.
Hi, this is Ron Butwin, and I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. My birth date is December 13th, 1946.
Zippy?
Zippy Kaplan, born on August 18th, 1946, in St. Paul, actually lived in Highland Village, but was born in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And where did you go to high school, and what was your year of graduation?
I went to St. Paul Central High School, and I graduated in June of 1964.
I went to U High, and I graduated in June of 1964.
Ron, do you recall the first time you got a drum set and where you got it?
Well, I started out, Tom, with a drum, just one drum to begin with. And I was 12 years old, and I had a little snare drum. And I eventually got a drum set at 13 years old from a place in downtown Minneapolis called Dahlgren's Drum Shop. And it was a Slingerland drum set, white pearl. And it was the drum set that Gene Krupa had made famous. And it was very popular at that point amongst a lot of rock and roll drummers. And so that was my first drum set. It was a great drum set. And if it was around today, it would probably be worth quite a lot of money.
And Zippy, do you recall the first guitar you played on?
Yeah, my parents got me a cheap Harmony acoustic. And I learned how to play on that. That was, I think, 1960. In fact, the very first jobs that we did as the Uniques, both John Sklar and I had those acoustics. And then about a year after that, I went to B Sharp, and I got my 62 Fender Jazzmaster, and I got my Blonde Bandmaster. And both of those are worth a lot of money now.
So let's hear some background on how the Uniques came to be.
It was kind of that old story of that era, which was some young guys fall in love with music, fall in love with playing whatever their instrument was going to be, drums or guitar, piano, whatever. And Zippy and I knew each other, and we just loved the fact that we loved the ventures. We loved the same music at that time. And we started hanging out a lot more and playing music together, listening to music. And that's the start of the band. It started to become something that we played more and more. Friends of ours used to love to listen to us play. We got more excited about it as we got a little bit better. And then we met another guy that, his name was John Sklar, and he was a guitar player. And he had he liked the music, but he also liked other music, such as rhythm and blues and so on. But we kind of got together, the two guys with their acoustic guitars and me with my Gene Krupa drum set, and we just started playing together. And we were playing everything from folk songs, because that was very popular at that era. And the Twin Cities had a few folk clubs, downtown St. Paul, downtown Minneapolis, where they would get together and do their different groups, three-part harmony, four-part harmony, but it was all Michael Row Your Boat Ashore and those kinds of things, and some beginning stuff that Dylan was starting to get into. And we were just playing wherever we could play. We'd play in high schools, we'd play at churches and synagogues, we'd play at any place that would let us play. And there are pictures of us as this young group of guys, and we just had a lot of fun playing. And there wasn't a lot of friends we had that were playing instruments with the interest that we had. So in Highland Park, where we grew up, it was just us. And we just started to have a following of friends that liked us, and that kind of pushed us on more. And we're getting better. We actually made a record, an acetate, back in those days. And we thought we were probably the best band in the world at 13, 14 years old. And this was pre-decent studios like today. And Tom and I have both heard the thing, and we look back and we think, how could we have thought that we were that good at that time? But it's pretty amazing to see the growth of the group.
It was pretty crude. It was really cool.
Where was that recorded?
Downtown Minneapolis. Somebody that he knew, that Ron knew, had a studio down there.
Yeah.
So we went down there. It was all live. There was no overdubs. It was just, we just played. And that was on the acoustics, too, no less. And then he made an acetate for us. And Ron got one, I got one. And we thought we were doing something. Boy, I listen to that now, and I got to shut it off almost. But it's kind of fun to listen to, because I hear so many wrong notes and off time stuff that it's just amazing.
The interesting thing about it is that showed you how much you loved music at that time. Is that we just were absorbed by it, and to be able to play it and make what we thought was going to be a fun record to have, which it is a fun. Was really something. It's just the love of what we were doing at that time and the excitement of the music industry and how groups were just starting to pop up all over the place.
I just want to add, too, that even though we were an instrumental band primarily, John did sing on some stuff. So it was a combination of vocal songs and instrumental songs.
Now, Zippy, you had an experience in junior high where you saw some of your classmates perform a Jan and Dean song. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I was in the auditorium. They used to have these deals, and this was in junior high, where they'd bring everybody into the auditorium, and they'd have a little show that they would do. And all of a sudden, these two guys, and I knew the guys, was Tom Stillman and Bob Lowenstein were their names. They got up, and they had two acoustics, and they sang, and they're actually pretty good. And they did Baby Talk by, actually, it was Jan and Arnie, before it was Jan and Dean. And I heard that, and I saw him playing, and I heard him singing. I go, God, I love that. I got to do that, because I was terrible at sports. You know, it wasn't my thing. And that just excited me to the point. That's when I went to my parents, and that's when they said, okay, we'll buy a cheap $10 harmony guitar. And I took about 8 lessons and said, the hell with this. Went home and started learning stuff by ear off Ventures albums. And that's how it really all started. And I got to say that one of the reasons Ron and I put that thing together was because of Walk, Don't Run. It was huge. And we wanted to do that. We wanted to do just like what they were doing.
Do you remember where you were when you first heard Walk, Don't Run the first time?
No, I was on the radio. I was probably screwing around in the neighborhood or something. And we had a little. I had a little transistor radio back then. And I that's probably the first place I heard it. And I listened to WDGY all the time at home. And I heard it there, too. And then I saw the Ventures on their first appearance on Dick Clark's show that he had on Saturday nights. I'm not sure if that was Bandstand or another show. Probably Bandstand. And the interesting thing about it is that I could vaguely and remember that and kind of see it in my head. But over the last couple of years, that actual segment popped up on YouTube. So I got to see it again for real. And it was really interesting.
Let me just...
Because they were lip-syncing, of course.
But. Let me respond to that. Because it was so important to our starting that group and music for us, I heard the song, my family, we were on a road trip. We were on our way to Florida, and that song comes on, and my parents, whatever they were listening to was not rock and roll. All of a sudden, the song comes on, and I'm like in the back seat, and I'm sure we must have been 12 years old, maybe 13. That song hit, and I just sat. I was glued to it. I couldn't wait for, in those days, they often played the same songs every hour in a lot of stations. And I couldn't wait to hear it again. And when I got back from the trip, I called Tom up, and I said, I just heard this song on this trip. It's so cool. We got to play it. And he had heard the same song while I was gone. And that was it. That's the song that really pulled us together.
We were 14. I just figured
it out. Was it 14?
Yeah. Because when we started playing...
Yeah,
I was 15 already. And you're right behind me,
right.
The same age basically. And we were when we started playing, I was 15 and 16. And, I mean, we weren't playing at 13 and 14 yet, not in the group.
I was playing. I was playing Dixieland music and things.
Oh,
like
you were?
That.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't know
but
that.
But that was different.
Where did the band practice?
His basement.
The band would practice in the basement of our house in St. Paul in Highland Park on Mount Curve. It was an ideal setup. We could spread the equipment out at that time, not knowing how big equipment was going to become for us over time. And we'd practice there, and we would...
There's a shrine there now for it.
No. And it would be very interesting because the guys loved to practice at our house because my mother would make sure to come down during the practice a few times to bring us cookies or things to eat. And so it just became a place on... Friday nights or Sundays or Saturday, whatever it was, to rehearse. And it was a comfortable place to do it.
Now, do you recall the name of the song or songs you recorded on the acetate?
Oh, I know what they are.
Go ahead.
We did Perfidia. We did Blue Moon. We did, I think we did Walk, Don't Run.
I'm sure.
We did Bluer Than Blue. Maybe we didn't do Bluer Than Blue. I'm trying to think of it. There was some other song that was just
Rawhide?
I can't remember, but there was some jam song we did that we thought was an original, which really was just
I know what it is. It's on here.
Oh, it is? What it's called?
The R&J Special.
Oh, yes. Okay. That's what it was.
Well, that must have cost some money to do.
Apache. We did Apache.
Yeah.
If it did, he paid it for it, because I don't remember.
I think what we did is...
Didn't we get it for free?
We worked it out with this guy. Something. I probably traded something time-wise or whatever for him. But whatever it was, they let us have the place for free. We did pay something, a few dollars, for the acetates. I mean, he was really nice about it. We paid him whatever it was to get a couple copies of acetates.
Let's run through the song list of the Uniques in this time period.
We were really basically an instrumental group by this time. I mean, John would sing a couple things, but it was Walk, Don't Run, the McCoy, which was the flip side of Walk, Don't Run, Blue Moon, Venture's version, Torture, that was a Fenderman instrumental, mm-hmm. Bluer Than Blue. Well, I do see Bluer Than Blue on it. Maybe that was 62. It's on the Colorful Ventures album. So that was a Venture song. Rawhide, that was Link Wray. Detour was Duane Eddy. Sentimental Journey, there's one that we did as an instrumental, but we did it like some trio in a jazz club or something would do it. And John played lead, too, so we traded off on the leads. Sleepwalk, he played lead on that. That was Santo and Johnny. Caravan, we did the basic version of that, which was based off the Count Basie, I think it was Count Basie version. Perfidia, that one we did adventure style. Waylon, that was a Venture song. Dream, that's another one like Sentimental Journey. Yellow Jacket, Ventures. Rocky Road, I have no idea what that is. Rumble was Link Wray. The Twist, I think John sang that.
That's the Chubby Checker song?
Yeah, I've Had It. I think he sang that too.
Got the Whole World?
Then he sang that. We did Night Train, Torquay, Blue Tango.
And then we did a few others at that time. By the next dance, that's probably all we knew how to play. At that point, if we had to play an evening, we probably did one set, and if we had some of these in the second set, and then we just started to do them all over again. But then we added some more. We added Waylon, Mashed Potatoes. We added Night Train, Greenfields, because folk stuff was getting more popular. Honky Tonk, Never on Sunday from the movie, Torquay, and then Perfidia.
But those are on that other list, too, already.
Right.
So how long does the first version of the Uniques last?
Well, we formed in 1960, and I think John left in 62, somewhere in 62, and then we got Shell on sax, Larry Cable on bass, Ken Blank on rhythm, and as a lead singer. And then we were pretty divided. About half the set was vocals, the other half mm-hmm. was instrumentals. And that went through 63. Possibly into the first part of 64.
I'm guessing it went into the first part of 64, yep. And then it...
Okay, so let's go through the second version of the Uniques. Who's playing what, and where are these guys from?
All right, so on the second version, we had a guy by the name of Ken Blank, who lived in Minneapolis, and he was the rhythm guitar player and did the lead vocals. And then we brought in a sax player from St. Louis Park, who played sax and did some vocals, and his name was Shell Gullickson. He was very good. We enjoyed having him in the group. We had Zippy was obviously in that group, and I was. We were the core members. And then on bass, we had a guy by the name of Larry Red Cable, and he was our bass player, and he was also from Minneapolis.
So now is the band doing more vocals?
Yes.
About half and half. Now it's about half vocal, half instrumental, instead of being mostly instrumental.
And on the vocals, would these be top 40 songs off
Pretty
the radio?
Much. You know, Shell sang Surfer Joe, and Ken sang Twist and Shout, and, you know, what's that one?
Whoa.
I Need Your Lovin'. Yeah. You know, stuff that was big in the early 60s, so it was on the radio. Then some Chuck Berry, whatever. And we even did, towards the end, we even did a couple Beatles. We did I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I saw her standing there right before the end.
Now, I understand you made a connection with a local band promoter named Clarence Haney. How did that come about?
The way we got to Clarence Haney, we had a guy that had offered to be our manager. Lo and behold, you know, who would have thought that managers would maybe be a little flaky or you couldn't depend on them? But we learned very quickly. There was a guy in St. Paul, and that he was offering to handle us. And he was a much older man. He had come from actually doing burlesque show, you know, booking burlesque shows and things like that. And he was going to handle us. And that just didn't work out. He was too much of a hustler. And he talked like Rodney Dangerfield, you know, everything he said. We just weren't sure on this guy. But through him, the name came up of Clarence Haney. And we hadn't heard anything of him. And so I called him up one night, and I told him who we were and what we were, these young guys from Highland Park that were putting this group together. This group was being put together, and we were having fun with it, and we'd like him to come and hear us. And he was really a nice guy. He was just wonderful. He came over to our house one night for practice, and he listened to the group, and he says, I really like you guys. You have a lot of promise, you know. He did say that he'd come over, which he did come over, and he listened to us, and he was very nice. We all liked him, and he said, I'd like to work with you guys. I used to do this for a living, and he booked like Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs and all those kinds of groups from that era, that 50s era group. He was friends with Johnny and the Hurricanes.
Actually, Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs was later.
Well, they were the Fireballs.
But it was the Fireballs. Fireballs. Yeah,
the Fireballs is a different thing than Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. It's two different things.
Well, Haney was...
Fireballs were late 50s, so that's probably what Ron meant.
Right.
Because Jimmy Gilmer wasn't until the mid-60s.
Well, Clarence was booking also local bands.
Yeah,
like
a lot of them.
The Glen Rays.
Yeah.
And the Del Ricos and so forth. So.
Yeah, and I actually wrote an original song because we wanted to get it recorded called Sandtrap, and Clarence really liked it. And I don't know why, what happened with him, but he got involved with a female vocalist, Diane Moond, and she actually got signed to it wasn't Kama Sutra. I'm trying to think of the name of the label. She got signed and went to California and had a fairly decent national hit with "I Want to Be Your Lover," and then followed it up with "The Beginning of the End," and then her third hit was I think Perfect Stranger or something like that. Anyway, she actually got fairly up the ladder fairly high, and I don't know if he didn't have the time or the interest anymore in us, or I mean, do you remember what happened there?
I can put this in perspective. So what happened, he came and he saw us play. He liked us, said he'd like to help us, and he actually put us very quickly into a car show that was coming, the Ray Farnock car shows. And that was the main guy in the United States that put car shows on all over. So on that bill, I think that night was if I remember correctly, it was the Corvettes, which made sense. It was a car show. You know, why not have it? And then they had us. And I think there was one other group.
Probably Keith Zeller, because we did a bunch of those.
Yeah.
We did a bunch of car shows with Keith Zeller and the Starliners.
Where were these held?
This was at downtown at the St. Paul Auditorium, the old St. Paul Auditorium.
Right.
And so we played those things, and we very quickly saw that these other groups that were out there before us making a name, Keith Zeller's group was known a little more than we were, and the Corvettes had been around now for a while. And we saw each one of us was just very different styles. And so he put us into that. That went fine. He started finding some other jobs for us. The problem was Clarence was getting older. He was a much older man. He had been a actor in the movie. What was the very first All's Quiet on the Western Front, going back into the 1930s?
Yeah,
was he was a movie actor and a dancer, and he made his living at that early in his life. And I think what was happening was he was just aging to the point now that he started dealing, and he started dropping some of the groups, not because he was unhappy or they were unhappy, just because the pressure was getting to be too much. And so it was kind of like he faded out. And just said, you know, guys, I just can't do this anymore.
But that Diane Moon deal, that definitely had something to do with it. was taking up a lot of his time because he cut that deal for her initially. Eventually, she dropped him and went with the Hollywood people. But that I know that had something to do with it.
The end result was he was one of the few people that we met. There were others, but few people we met that was a booking agent, that was a promoter, and so on, that really did what he said he would do. He was honest. He was nice.
He was a good, he was really a nice guy.
His family, they would invite us sometimes over to their house to have something to eat or whatever. They were just the nicest people. So that's one of those few people. There's others, but one of the few people that everyone, had he been younger, he probably would have been handling many of the big bands.